like to call upon Atul Bora, Vice President at Dell.
I don't think I need a mic. I think Swamiji has inspired me enough. I don't need a mic. I just want to say I'm humbled by just being in the presence of this group here. For us, it's been a discovery that's still in the making, so it's not yet the journey home, but I hope we've taken a few steps in the path home. And I can just say that for each one, it's an individual journey. The book, just being with Swamiji, has been a very, very touching, inspiring period for us. But, you know, at the end of the day, this is all about the voice that comes from within. And the truth is, as someone said, there are two most important dates in your life. The first is the day you were born, and hope you all know that. And the second is the day you find out why you were born. So I really don't feel that I'm qualified to speak in the presence of Swami Radhanath, except to say that it is a very personal journey, but even if you have the ability to find it yourself, part of that journey is discarding your ego. And you need a guru, because otherwise you'll always say, I found the journey home. And that's part of what growing up and that process is. So it's again an honor to be here today, and I really want to make the time and space for others to come up and speak, and to thank Radhanath Swami for the inspiration and the blessings that we have all received. Thank you, and Hare Krishna.
I'd like to now call upon Patrick McBride. A wonderful person. He was a Marine who then had a nightclub and became a pastor of a church, and now leads several people, helps them in their journeys, and is the author of a wonderful book called Sundrops in Life. So Patrick, okay.
In truth, the only qualification I have for standing up here is that I can read, okay? The book Journey Home is a beautiful, beautiful book. It's the way I describe it to the people I've lent it to is it's Indiana Jones meets Autobiography of a Yogi. And it's a wonderful, wonderful adventure. From everything that we do in life, from every experience, there's a takeaway, something that we take away from that experience. And a book is an experience. It's an experience to write a book, and it's an experience to read a book. Because when you read a book, you're sharing the author's journey. You're sharing the author's experience, his adventure, or her adventure. In this book, the adventure is one of the soul, the spirit, and the body. And by becoming part of that story, it awakens something inside of you that says, this is the way to live, this is the way to journey. Your life has to be an adventure. One of the takeaways of this book is that your life become an adventure. And the more the adventure, the greater the adventure, the greater the treasure at the end of the adventure. This book is a great experience and a great adventure and a great guideline for life. And I thank Swami for writing it, and I thank everyone for listening. Thank you.
I'd like to call upon Sukumar Natarajan, director at SAP Labs, to say a few words.
I'm humbled to be and honored to be in such an august company. The quest of a teenage boy in the 1960s to go across continents, to hitchhike to India, when my wife recommended this book to me a few, 6-8 months ago, I said it's impossible. Nobody would do that. And then I read the book. Autobiography is not my genre, but when I read the book, it's truly an unputdownable. If ever a book can be written in that category, it is this book. It's truly an amazing, eye-opening book. I grew up in India, spent a vast majority of my life there, and I did not know anything about spirituality, anything about the gurus, anything about many of the things that are going on. It's an amazing, amazing, amazing book. I read through this book, and I'm not such a avid or a voracious reader. I read through this book start to finish, cover to cover in one night. And I got extremely lot more than I put into this. And I hope that you'll all do that too. Thank you, Swamiji, for giving us this blessing. Thank you for sharing your experiences with us. Thank you.
I'd like to call upon a wonderful personality now who's been very influential in my own personal life and the lives of several people in the Dallas Metroplex. His Grace Nityananda Prabhu, born to an affluent family in New Zealand, in Fiji, and studying law. He succumbed to the call of his heart. After 27 years of practicing Bhakti Yoga, he's now the governing body commission of ISKCON, Texas, Oklahoma, and Arkansas, and the chairman of the North American GDC. He holds degrees in law and accountancy. He's a successful businessman. And ironically, if you know of ISKCON, a staunch adversary of ISKCON. And then changing his path to a life completely dedicated to Bhakti Yoga. His is actually a tale as fascinating as the book we have gathered to launch today. Married to Manjali Devi, who is acclaimed to be the finest vegetarian cooks in the world today. And with two illustrious sons, he, along with his family, continues to inspire hundreds.
So thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. Pastor, as you spoke about your ability to read, I don't have many great abilities, but I will try to read. His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj is a legendary spiritual leader, an author, and public speaker. A practitioner of Bhakti Yoga for 40 years, his life is dedicated to help individuals find greater inner fulfillment through devotional service. Born in Chicago in 1950, he set out on a spiritual quest to wander the world in his teens and eventually discovered the yoga path of devotion. His present travels are in Asia, Europe, and America, teaching devotional wisdom, and is often at his community in Mumbai, India. People who know Radhanath Swami speak of his dedication to bringing others closer to God. Almost in the same breath, they speak of his lightness, simplicity, and sense of humor. Visitors and friends are inspired by his unassuming nature and natural unwillingness to take credit for the works he inspires. Developing communities, massive food distribution to indigent children, missionary hospitals, eco-friendly farms, schools, ashramas, and emergency relief programs. Through his gentle demeanor, divine, genuine compassion, and profound wisdom, he is touching the hearts of millions and filling them with love, inner peace, and God realization. I now request His Holiness Radhanath Swami to please grace us with his enlightening words. And as he is on his way here, let me also say that after he speaks, we would like you to ask questions, and then there will be the book signing ceremony part of the program. Thank you very much. His Holiness Radhanath Swami Maharaj.
Timidandasya Gyananjanachalakaya Chakshurum Bilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Kuruve Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prestaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Sunyavadi Paschatya Desatharine Vanshakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindubhya Evacha Patithanam Pavanibhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Hey Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kansana Gorangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Deve Pranamami Hari Priye Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare.
I'm very grateful to be among all of you this evening. Our special guests, Maharaji, and to everyone who has come. Every moment of life is so precious. We could lose money and get it back. We could lose friends and get them back. But if you waste a moment, we can never get that moment back. Great wise people throughout the ages have said, the most precious thing there is in life is every moment that we have. The choices we make at each moment determine not only our experience, but but our destination. I was asked to speak something about this book, The Journey Home, which is about choices I made when I was very young and how those choices affected every aspect of my life. As we have seen and heard, I was a teenager in the 1960s in America. I see that there are several people in our audience who were around at that time. You can't really know what it was like unless you were there, because there is the intellectual understanding of the history, but the actual emotions that drove us. As a child, I was brought up in a small town about 30 miles north of Chicago. When I was 15, I had a job, because my father, when I was younger, he invested all the money that he had along with his brother, and they took very risky loans to start a business venture that seemed so promising. They became the largest automobile dealers of a brand new model that the Ford Motor Company had just come out with. It was called the Edsel. It was the biggest disaster in automobile industry's history as far as losses. So he went into bankruptcy, and he struggled and he strived, and my mother, bless her soul, never complained, just somehow or other made ends meet while raising three extremely wild sons. She did all the cooking and all the cleaning and taking us to the doctors and dealing with our trouble we got in school and everything else. It's amazing, a mother's love. It's extremely rare that a child, especially a son, ever appreciates the total sacrifice of love of a mother. Usually we appreciate it after they die, or at least after we grow up and have our own children. But anyways, I didn't want to increase the burden, so I got jobs from 15 on, after school, on weekends. And most of the people I worked with were African American. And the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and all of those things give freedom to everyone. But it was only in the books. It was not in real life in the 1960s. Born in the ghetto, you live and you die in the ghetto. You have really practically no choice. And I saw the people I were working with. They were so beaten down, hopeless, unappreciated. Most of them were alcoholics. Why? I'm being taught in my nice little home, among my nice little teachers in school, that this is the land of the free. This is the land of opportunities. If you're a certain color. But what about these other people? This was painful and confusing. It seemed all so hypocritical. At the same time, there was a war raging in Vietnam, and when you turned 18, unless you had a deferment, You were drafted and forced to fight and either kill or die for something you don't believe in. And some of my friend's sons were sent back from Vietnam in wooden crates. Why? Meanwhile, the music of the 60s, they were like our prophets. They were singing about revolution, about peace and love, and about rejecting the norms and the values of our parents. Because the establishment of their generation didn't make sense to us. And a young mind becomes very influenced. And I found myself marching with Martin Luther King's people and getting bottles and stones and curses thrown at me by my white brothers and sisters. I found myself in Grant Park in Chicago at the Democratic conventions on a peaceful demonstration to just question the validity of the Vietnam War. And I was tear gassed and chased and clubbed down by the police, who I was taught were protecting my freedom. It wasn't just a philosophical query. It was very, very deeply painful. If I don't find answers, what is my life? Through social change, demonstrations, music, I was trying to find that. But unfortunately, I was little by little discovering that the counterculture that I was a part of had the same problems and issues as the people that we were fighting against, just in a different package. There was still ego. There was still prejudice. There was still hatred. There was still anger and envy. And there were, sometimes there's just a couple things that you hear in your life that really make you question. Should I share a few things? I heard a statement. I think it was Martin Luther King. If you do not have an ideal that you're ready to die for, you have nothing very meaningful to live for. And I heard Mahatma Gandhi. Be the change that you want to see in the world. And I came to understand that also meant be the change that you want to see in others. And one day I was listening with my stereo earphones in the basement of the house that I had decorated with psychedelic blacklight posters and strobe lights and incense so my parents wouldn't know what else those smells were. I guess I'm making confessions too, Swami. And I heard one singer sing a song that was called Look to Your Soul for the Answer. He was a popular singer. Little by little, I was turning to spirituality. I had to find meaning and purpose in my own life in order to make a change within this world. Otherwise, whatever I do is just superficial, without substance. I have to overcome vengeance and envy and greed and hate. I have to be the change that I want to see. So I was working one summer between college semesters when my best lifelong friend, oh, in those days I was 19, I knew him since we were about 8. His name was Gary. We used to travel together a lot in the summers. One year we went to California and Haight-Ashbury and all these places. Another year we went and slept on the sandy beaches of the Bahamas. We were trying to find something. We always were searching for something. He called me to meet him. He said, Frank and I are going on a trip to Europe. You must come. I said, Gary, I have no money, and I have a job to work, you know, to help me through college next semester. So I can't go. Gary said, well, I have no money either. But Frank wants to go so bad that he's willing to sponsor the two of us to go with him. I said, all right, I'll go. I said, when are you leaving? He said, in 3 days. So I went back. I hitchhiked home. I told my parents, I'm going for a summer trip to Europe. They were horrified because no one in their family since my grandfather and my grandmother's, you know, they immigrated due to religious persecution. They came to America. That was in around 1910. No one in any of our family had ever left the country. They were begging me not to go. But a parent trying to convince a teenager in the 1960s not to do something? I went. And we got, I think it was $65, a flight from New York to Iceland. Now, fortunately, there were no volcanoes, so we got a connecting flight to Europe. We ended up in Luxembourg, and I remember Frank didn't have all that much money either. We didn't know what to expend, but the first night, we slept in a tent in a field. It was like a campground. And the first morning when we woke up, we were so happy. We were in a new world. First time in our lives out of our country with absolutely no parental supervision. We're free. We're on our own. And Frank came out of the tent in a completely opposite mood. He was devastated. He said, I've been robbed of all my money. All we have is our return tickets. Let's go immediately. He slung his backpack over his shoulder and said, come, we're going back to New York. And Gary and I stood there. And he left. He kept walking. And I remember sitting beside a little creek and watching the water flowing and praying to God, let me learn this wisdom from this creek of water. She flows according to her natural course. Where is destiny going to lead me? It's interesting. Your whole consciousness is very different. When you're in a foreign land, you know no one, and you have nothing. You have to pray. You have to depend on other people's goodness. One thing I realized very quickly, I was not the controller. I had to learn to adjust to how destiny or the hand of God, however you want to interpret it, how it was leading me. And that was beautiful. When you put yourself in that type of situation, and I don't advise it to anyone, at least not like I did, please. But in our own way, in our own life, the most horrifying, dangerous things could come upon us. And the most beautiful gifts and treasures. In fact, miracles manifest all around us when we really put our arms in the air and say, I'm yours. Guide me. I remember Gary and I, we didn't know where to go. We wanted to go everywhere. We were young and enthusiastic to see the world and to see the sights and to search for God and to search for people and to make friends. And I remember we would sometimes think, should we go to Germany? Should we go to France? Should we go to Switzerland? Should we go to Spain? No, we should go to Morocco. We should go to England. And we decided we'll just stand on the side of the road and put our thumbs out to hitchhike, and wherever the driver was going that picked us up, that is where God wants us to be. That was our travel itinerary. Wherever the person was going on the side of the road. And I remember at one point we were at the Isle of Wight Rock Festival. Did any of you ever hear of that? At the time, it was the largest rock festival in the history of our generation, much bigger than Woodstock. 3 days of all the greatest bands in the Western world in that model of rock and roll. And we were listening, and they were great performances. And I remember sitting there as Jimi Hendrix was playing. I was just maybe 10 yards away from the stage. Those amplifiers were so loud because there was over 500,000 people that it had to reach. It was blaring, the drums and the guitars and the screaming. But the silent calling within my heart was so loud, I couldn't even hear the music. It was calling me away from all of this stuff in search of inner meaning and fulfillment. Just a few days later, in our hitchhiking, we met some people. They put us up in their little apartment in Surbiton, England. Gary and I were amused because they put coins, a little machine, every couple hours to get electricity, which was not something we had in America. But one morning, Mark, he started to cry. He said he just read in the newspaper Jimi Hendrix was dead. He died of an overdose of alcohol and sleeping pills. And my faith in the counterculture kind of died along with him. He's a prophet. He's an idol that our whole generation is looking up to. And he had fabulous wealth, fabulous fame, and incredible artistic abilities. But he had no inner happiness or peace. What do I really want? Gary and I, from that point, we spent almost all of our time in museums studying art to get spiritual symbolism. And going to synagogues, cathedrals, Franciscan monasteries, trying to put together the clues that would give us a real direction for a meaningful and real life. It led us through Switzerland, France, Holland, and eventually we were on an island in Greece. And it's a long story, but I had a calling on the top of a mountain, praying, meditating, and reading books from sunrise to sunset. That day I was weeping for direction. And I heard three words. And when I heard those three words, I knew if I follow this calling, everything of my past is gone. And my whole life, everything will be new and dangerously challenging. Am I willing to do it? Those three words were, go to India. It was a silent voice from within. And I honestly and sincerely believed it to be the word of the words of God. Because I was so deeply focused and tuned in longing and yearning and praying for direction. I went back to the cave. Gary was sitting in meditation. I said, something incredible happened to me today. Gary said, something incredible happened to me. At sunset, I heard three words. So what did he say? He said, you won't believe me. I said, I might. He said, go to Israel. I slid myself closer and said, where? I didn't hear you. Where? He said, I told you you wouldn't believe me. I said, no, I believe you, but I didn't hear you. Where? He said, don't you believe me? I said, no, just tell me again. Where? He said, Israel. He told me to go to India. Gary yelped, India? There was complete silence for about 20 minutes as I was looking out at the stars over the Mediterranean Sea. And I remember whispering into the heavens, yes, I am willing. Then I told Gary, at sunrise tomorrow, I'm leaving for India. He was shocked and very upset. I was going to leave him all alone on this island. And he said, hitchhiking through the Middle East is different than hitchhiking through Europe. It's very dangerous. You have no money. You have no friends. You can't do it. It's suicide. I told him, I believe this is God's calling. I must go. And I cannot wait. The next morning, I left him. And hitchhiking is a very nice experience. I hitchhiked by a fishing boat to get to Athens. And I remember looking out at the sea. I was alone. I had nothing. And as the waves were tossing, I was wondering where destiny was going to toss me. I never had met an Indian in my life. I never ate Indian food. I didn't know where India was. And I didn't have a map or any money to buy one. But I just decided I'm going to keep hitchhiking in the eastern direction, and someday maybe I'll arrive in India. So I did that. Turkey at the time was going through a massive epidemic of cholera. And everyone told me, don't go. But I was enthusiastic. I was also stupid. I went. We got to the Greek border, and he said, there's a no man's land of several kilometers between Greece and Turkey, because we're enemies, and our borders are closed. If you go through there, you're not going to be allowed back in. So go back where you came from, because the Turkish borders are closed because of the cholera epidemic, and we won't let you back in. It's a no man's land with wolves and snakes and no water and no food. You will die. Don't go. It was just sunset. He said, we're closing our post in 1 minute. What are you going to do? And I was with two others who decided to hitchhike part of the way with me. And I said, we'll go. He said, then you will die. And we're not responsible. And we went through into the no man's land, and the gates, big iron gates, slapped shut with barbed wire, and the guards with machine guns stood. We started walking. We started seeing snakes. Saw a skeleton. it got dark, and the wolves started howling, and we couldn't see anything, and we were walking, and it was getting really freezing cold. And then I realized, I just made a big mistake. What if the border's closed? They definitely won't let me back. Anyways, it's amazing how close to God I came in that. It was about a 1.5 hour walk in total darkness. And we had no flashlights. And when we got to the border, it was closed. He said the guard wouldn't let us in. And we begged and we pleaded. And he was so angry. And somehow or other, you'll read in the book if you get it, we got in. It wasn't easy. And our first night in Istanbul was transforming, to say the least, where we were trapped in a den of murderers. Somehow we escaped and hitchhiked through Turkey and hitchhiked through Iran. There I met a man named Ibrahim, who was a very gentle, compassionate scholar of the Quran in a place called Mashhad. And he taught me the Quran and taught me about Islam. And what he taught me and his own example was so beautiful and so uplifting. And I was learning more and more from the Franciscan monks to the Jewish rabbis to the Islamic scholars that the essence of all these great religions is not to be a Muslim or a Jew or a Christian, but to love God and to be a compassionate instrument of God's love to everyone. I wanted to find that, and I wanted to be that. And then I hitchhiked into Afghanistan, which was the poorest country I've ever seen in my life. But in those days, the people were the most hospitable, the most generous, and kind. Of course, a lot of them were stoned on hashish. But they were really nice people. They just let me in their homes. They were so simple and loving. And some of the most transformative, life-changing experience happened to me in Afghanistan. In Kandahar, I was sitting with a very nice man on his rooftop. Should I tell the story? I was sitting there, we were talking philosophy. He was a very wealthy trader of imports, exports. And suddenly, as we're talking, it was night, he cocked his head up toward the moon and started to howl. Ow! And I thought, has my host become mad? I never saw anything like this. He was howling and howling and howling, and then he picked up a rope and there was a little loop at the end of the rope, and he threw it down to the ground from the top of the roof, and he waited a few minutes and pulled it up, and there was a mongoose in it. And he let the mongoose go on his rooftop, and then he came back and started talking philosophy to me. As we were talking, I felt these mongoose claws piercing my back as it was crawling up my gray turtleneck shirt. And he went right behind my neck. My hair in those days was halfway to my waist. And he liked my hair a lot. And he made a nest in my hair and went to sleep. He was really heavy. It was painful. And I told my friend, I said, please take your mongoose off of me. He sipped his tea and looked at me in the eyes. and said, there is a saying, never wake a sleeping mongoose. Mongoose is so terrible when they are angry that they can slay the cobra, the very symbol of death. If you awaken that mongoose, he may rip your head to shreds. So don't move an inch until he leaves on his own. So I was sitting there on a rooftop, 1 hour, 2 hours, and this mongoose was breaking my neck, and I felt it was like a time bomb that could go off at any moment. And then my friend started falling asleep, and he said, excuse me, but I have to go to sleep. So he left, and I was alone. And I remember asking God, why is this happening to me? Then I tried to think in a positive way. I thought, at least somebody likes my hair. Because everyone used to condemn me for my long hair. In those days, to wear long hair was a very social, political statement of revolution. It wasn't a style. But then I realized that the mongoose didn't come alone. I started feeling all these insects biting into my scalp, biting and biting. And my mind was going disarray. And then I thought, what am I supposed to learn from this? Every situation, we can interpret it to be a curse or a blessing. That's our choice, whatever it may be. And I somehow or other, I had no choice of what was going to happen. But I had a choice of how I was going to perceive it. And isn't that true in every situation in life that we're all in? We may not have control over what's happening to us, but we do have control of how we're going to perceive it. Are we going to be grateful and grow? Or are we going to be cursing it and get nowhere? I had a lot of time to think that night because I couldn't do anything else. I couldn't move. And I started thinking, maybe God sent this mongoose to teach me patience. Because on the spiritual path, patience is so sacred. And as soon as I thought that, the pain was the same. The danger was the same. But it became very meaningful. And internally, I was very happy. About 6 hours passed. And when the sun was rising, the mongoose on his own crawled down my back, jumped on the ground, and looked up at me with those little mongoose shiny eyes. And he looked at me almost with such innocence, like he was thanking me. And I felt he was one of my gurus to teach me something. And later on, I were to find he taught me something that I desperately had to learn before I continued on with my journey. Many things happened in Afghanistan. Then I went through Pakistan, crossing the Khyber Pass. And I hitchhiked across that. From Istanbul to the border of India took me 3 months. From London to Greece took me 3 months. It was a 6 month hitchhike. I can honestly say now when I take that journey from London to India, it takes 8 hours. The same journey took me 6 months. The airplane appears to be safer, but not near as scenic and not near as life-changing. In those 3 months it took me to get across overland to India, I honestly felt that I had aged about 30 years. I was not at all anymore a teenager coming from the suburbs of Chicago. I had learned many things, beautiful things, and some of the ugliest, most horrible things I've ever experienced in life. But I felt it all helped me to come closer to God. I walked across the no man's land between Pakistan and India, again, two enemy countries, and there was the border. It was in a jungly field. And my heart was soaring with anticipation. The rishis and the yogis and the sages and the lamas and the Himalayas and the Ganges and all the things I've been reading about are just steps away. I finally made it. I was covered with dust. I handed the immigration agent my passport. It had an authorized visa for India. I was thrilled. I finally made it. There were dozens of times while hitchhiking through the Middle East that I was sure I was going to die and never make the land of my dreams. But here I was, only a couple steps away. And that immigration agent looked at my passport and asked the question I was hoping and praying would never be asked. How much money do you have? I had a cloth bag. It was in Kabul. I lost my sleeping bag, and in some other place running for my life, I lost all the clothes I had except what I was wearing. So I looked in my cloth bag. It took me a few minutes. I scrimped up all my money. I remember exactly. It was 26 cents in four different currencies. She looked at that, and it was like a scorpion of disgust crawled across her face. She said, "You need at least $200 to come into my country." And I started to plead with her and tell her all that I've gone through and my appreciation for her people and her culture. And she scorned and shouted at me, "We have enough beggars in India. We do not want another one. Go back. You are refused." I was determined. But the more I begged, the angrier she became. Hours went by. I kept coming back and bothering her until finally she had the security guards point their rifles in my face and say, "Go back." So I sat under a tree. I walked 20 kilometers that day to get there. To hitchhike back? I couldn't, because I wasn't allowed back in Pakistan. I only had a one-way visa. Again, it was beyond my control. I was powerless. I was just a little skinny guy sitting there under a tree between two enemy nations with armies on both sides of the border. I prayed. And it wasn't just a ritualistic prayer. It was from the depth of my heart. I was crying. The guard shifted, and a tall, elderly Sikh man took the post. And she drove off in her jeep. And when she was totally out of sight, I went to him. And I handed him my passport, and he wouldn't even take it. He said, "I've been warned about you by my superior officer. You are nothing but a nuisance. Go back. You are not allowed." I started to cry. It wasn't false tears. It was for real. I was mortified and desperate. With a choked voice, I begged, "Please give me a chance to meet your people, to learn from your culture. And I promise you someday I'll try to do something good for your people." He gazed into my eyes for a long time. and he spoke. He said, sometimes a man must follow his heart. My superior officer ordered me not to let you in. But I am going to give you the chance that you are crying for. He took my passport and stamped it. I can still hear the sound of that stamp. And then he put his hand on my head and said, my son, may you find what you're crying for. Welcome to India. I crossed the border. By that time it was dark, and I was just walking through fields. I didn't know where to go or how to get there. I was just walking, but I felt at home. I felt so blessed. Wherever a star was shining, wherever a tree had leaves, I felt this is where I'm supposed to be. And eventually I went to the Himalayas. I remember my first day. I was sitting on the bank of the river Ganges, meditating and praying in a very, very secluded place. There was nobody else around. On one side were beautiful foothill mountains of Himalayas. On another side, I saw some yogis sitting in trance. Hours went by when I saw coming out of the forest was a holy man. He was walking with his eyes toward the sand. He had a golden complexion and a long gray beard and hair. His robes were floating in the breeze from the river. He walked right up to me. I stood up to receive him. His first words, I know who you are, but you do not know me. I have been watching you. I admire your determination. Now take off your Western clothes and throw them in Mother Ganges. And I will give you the robes of a sadhu. I asked, what is a sadhu? I never heard the word. He said, a sadhu is a homeless wanderer who seeks divine truth. Or you may say a monk. Then he handed me. He said, I will give you the robes. Now take off your Western clothes. It's the only clothes I had. Gray jeans with thin black pinstripes. And I really thought they were cool. I was really attached to them. Because when it's all you have, you really identify with it. They were not my clothes. They were me. They were my personality. And I had a gray turtleneck shirt with horizontal pinstripe black going across. I took off my jeans and said a prayer. Threw them in the river. They were gone forever. It was a very, very rapid current. Then I took off my shirt and gone forever. I was standing in my underpants. And I put on, he just had these two sheets just like this. Just sheets of cotton. I said, those are clothes? He said, he taught me how to wrap one around my waist and one around my upper part. And then he had these two strips. He said, these will be your underpants. Throw your underpants in the Ganges. Now, this was becoming serious surrender the first day. I took off my underpants. I remember they were Fruit of the Loom. And it was my only pair. They were gone. And I was dressed as a sadhu. And then he said one more thing to me. The Ganges will become your mother. You will understand this because she will reveal it in time. Then he turned around and walked away, and I never saw him again. I found a cave in the jungle where I lived. I lived in many caves. I would say this was a two-star cave among caves. And every day I sat on a rock in the middle of the Ganges, and from sunrise to sunset I meditated and I prayed. And wonderful things started happening. In the Bible it is said, seek and ye shall find. Knock and the door will open. God could reveal truths to us that are essential for our progress if we're really seeking it. Through the most likely or unlikely places. Could reveal it when we're reading the Bible or the Vedas. Could reveal it when we're meeting a holy person. Could reveal it when we're meeting an enemy or a mongoose. In this case, I had no one around except the river. I learned more sitting on that rock in the Ganges of what I felt was valuable to my life than I learned through all my years of school. May I share with you a couple lessons? I remember seeing the Ganges, how her waves were rippling and swirling. It was a very fast current. It was just so beautiful. She was just coming down from the peaks of the Himalayas. Her water was very transparent, aqua blue, rich in color. And as I was seeing the formations of the ripples and the swirls of her waves, I was thinking, this is the most beautiful art, with color, with texture, with fragrance. No human artist could ever fully capture it. And yet this art, it disappears as soon as it appears. It's ever changing. Nothing is constant. What am I to learn from this? That on the external platform of the world we live in, everything is always changing. But deep down, in the current, there is a constant truth. So do I want to remain on the surface, living a superficial life, or do I want to go deep down to find that constant, eternal current of truth in my connection with God, my connection with nature, and my connection with other living beings? I was yearning and longing to find that depth within myself. And I was watching as the Ganges was coming down from the high Himalayan mountains flowing toward the sea, over 1,000 miles. And how many obstacles were in her path? Right in front of me, there were giant mountains that she was flowing around. There was huge rocks that she was flowing over, under, or around. Nothing could stop her journey to the sea. And similarly, obstacles will come in our path of life, whatever it may be. But like the Ganges, we have to learn to be fluid. We have to learn to be flexible. However strict we are in our religion or our spirituality or our, whatever our goal may be, we have to be fluid like the Ganges and determined. Whatever comes in our path, in whatever form, to flow around it or over it or under it, because nothing could stop our destination to the sea with the grace of God. For a month I sat on that rock, and some of the most beautiful gifts in my life were received from the river. And I remember that sage who told me that the Ganges will become your mother. She nourished me with her water and with her wisdom and with so much more. From there, I went to live with Maharishi Mahesh Yogi in his world headquarters in Rishikesh. I had lived with Swami Rama. During my travels, Swami Satchidananda, J. Krishnamurti, at one time, I was living in a cave with a yogi named Tatwala Baba, who would sit unmoving in meditation, sometimes 6 to 10 hours at a time. And he told me he would like me to stay in his cave with him for the rest of my life. I was honored, and I was attracted. But then I was thinking, you know, I think I want to see some more places before I make such a decision. But I was afraid. How do you say no to a yogi like this? He has supernatural powers. I don't know what he'll do if I refuse his invitation. Anyways, while he was meditating, I would meditate. But every now and then, I'd open my eyes and look around. And I remember from this, his cave was high in a cliff, looking down at a Himalayan jungle. I saw leopards. I saw cobras. I saw some wild elephants. I saw wild boars. I saw all kinds of incredible birds. And I remember thinking back to Highland Park, Illinois, where I was grown up. It was the morning. I was thinking, in Highland Park at this time of the day, in the flat terrain, the children, we all stood at the bus stop waiting for the bus as our parents got in their cars and drove off to work. And our mothers were home, you know, doing the cooking and cleaning and whatever else they were doing. I was thinking, what a different world I'm living in. I was so grateful. But I would wonder, what's happening to my parents' heart? You see, I was supposed to be home after 2.5 months. I gave my promise. 3 months passed. No word from me. 4 months passed. Can you imagine a mother and father, how they worried? And my mother and father really worried. They seriously were in anxiety. When I was in college, if I did not call them when I was supposed to call them, they would start, you know, checking police to see if I was arrested or to see if anybody died. They were really worrisome people. 4 months passed. No word from me. Then they got a letter. In the letter, it read, I'm hitchhiking to India. I have seen 19 years of how the Western mind sees the world. Now I want to view the world through the vision of people of the East. Gary's no longer with me. Sometimes I'm alone, sometimes I have companions. And then, with such compassion in my heart, I ended the letter by saying, please don't worry. That didn't reach their hearts, that part. They were in anguish. And there was no return address on that letter. because I was in a different place every day. From Tatwala Baba's camp, I crossed over the Ganges to go into the higher Himalayas. And I'll never forget, in a clearing, I came into a leprosy colony. It was horrible. I saw people without fingers, without toes. Some people were practically naked with filthy, shattered rags around them. Many were homeless. I saw some people, they dug holes in the ground and covered themselves with dirt to warm themselves from the Himalayan cold. Some had noses that melted off. They surrounded me, screaming out, "Bakshish, bakshish," which means give me a donation. But I had no money. But they didn't believe me. There was about a dozen of them in a tight circle around me. They wouldn't let me move. They were demanding money. And they were fighting with each other to get in the front of that mob so that they would be the ones that got the money. About 20 minutes passed and I couldn't move, and they were screaming at me with such desperation in their eyes. I was thinking in my mind, this is horrible. Why are they doing this to me? And then I was thinking, in their condition, anything they do is justified. Why am I feeling sorry for me? I should feel sorry for them. And then I started thinking, I don't know anything about leprosy, but I remember in the movies, it's contagious. I might get leprosy. They're touching me. They're breathing on me. They're spitting on me. It was very confusing, to say the least. It was a culture shock. And finally, they patted me down and saw I had nothing, and they let me go. I walked a few steps, and what I saw on the left side of me, maybe about 30 feet away, I stopped in my tracks. There was an old leper woman. She looked really close to death. Her face was deformed. Her skin was decomposing. Her nose was melted into a hole in her face. She had no teeth. She had scraggly white hair. She was laying on her left side. The most pathetic thing I'd ever seen. And she looked at me. And in her eyes, I saw the love of a mother. It was as if she was really feeling pain that I had just gone through what I did with her people. It was almost like through her eyes, she was begging forgiveness for what her people had done to me. There was such affection. What I experienced in her glance changed my life forever. It was a woman who wanted to love like a mother, but for years and years had no one to love. She was yearning and longing for someone to simply accept her love. She offered her greetings to me by folding her hands like this, and then she put a fingerless hand out as a blessing. I was so melted by her affection, I ran over to her, fell on my knees, and put my head under her hand. I heard her say over and over again in the Hindi language, "May God bless you, my child. May God bless you, my child. May God bless you." I looked up. Her face was illuminated with joy. She was smiling, and there were tears flowing from her eyes. she wanted, what every mother wants to do, to bless a child. This may be hard for you to understand, but when I looked up at her face, I was thinking, she is the most beautiful person I've ever seen in my life. I left her and wandered north in the Himalayas for some time and sat on the bank of the river Ganges and tried to ponder what I'm supposed to learn from that experience. The waves of the Ganges, I could see so much of the river, but under the surface, there's so many millions of fish and millions of stones and so much vegetation. How much can we see? In the same way, on the surface, she was the most ugly, hopeless, diseased person I ever met in my life. But below the surface, in her heart, was someone who simply wanted to love and be loved. A generous, loving heart who wanted nothing from anyone but to receive the love she wanted to give. She didn't ask me for anything else. And I was thinking how this can apply to so many aspects of life. In religion, there's so much conflict on the basis of particular historical explanations of what God is, according to differences of rituals, differences of dogma, differences of culture, differences of language. But if we go deeper down, we may find a beautiful universal essence within all. And when we look at people, people who really disturb us, they may be like the way they are because they were abused, because they were neglected, because they were brokenhearted. If we look below the surface of a person's behavior, instead of being hateful, we'll probably be sympathetic. And circumstances. Circumstances may look a certain way, but if we look deeper, we may find something very beautiful that we can find in it. That leper lady was one of my great gurus in life. From there, I lived with Ananda Mayi Ma. I read there was a whole chapter about her, an autobiography of a yogi. And I remember one thing that she said that deeply moved me. She said, love is everlasting forgiveness. And she said, when God gives pain, God gives us pain to remove all pain forever. God gives us sorrow to remove all sorrow forever. If we just turn to God in those situations. And she also said that whatever you're doing, keep the name of God always in your heart. I was hearing this from so many people about the name of God. And I heard the name of God at the Ganges. It was gradually becoming something very relevant to me. I traveled north and lived with Naga Babas. That was a very interesting experience. Each one of them had a trident with a skull on it. They covered their body with ashes. And they lived only wearing a bright red loincloth and were naked other than that. And they taught me some really good lessons in ways that I was not prepared for. And I lived with Kailash Baba, a huge mountain of a man who was almost looked fearsome with his long matted hair. He hadn't cut his hair in 60 years. But he was like a kind father. He taught me how to live in the jungle, what leaves and herbs and plants I could eat and what I couldn't eat, how to beg with dignity and integrity, how to honor, respect, and live as neighbors with leopards and cobras and scorpions and other animals. He taught me that you are in their home. You are their guest. Honor them and respect them. See that God is in their heart and respect that divinity within them, and they won't hurt you. And he lived that way. He said, don't embrace, he didn't say it, but he taught me, don't embrace them. Give them their space with honor and integrity. And one of the more difficult things, sometimes even more difficult than the leopards and the cobras and the tigers, is he taught me how to mix with different sects of sadhus. How to honor and respect them. I learned so much from him. And the interesting thing, he did not speak a word of English and I did not speak a word of Hindi. He taught me all these treasures of instructions by his glances, by his gestures, by the tone of his voice. Where there's a will to teach and there was a will to learn, there's a supernatural energy beyond even language to transmit that wisdom. Anyways, I traveled on. I think I'm going over time, but I always do. But I won't go too much longer. And I went through Himalayas, and I went down to Varanasi, where I sat on the bathing ghats, watching bodies, the burning ghats, watching bodies burn from sunrise to sunset, trying to understand the truth of death. Because I had this thought, unless I really understand what death is, I'll never really understand what life is. I went to Bodh Gaya and studied with a Zen Buddhist master and Satyanarayan Goenka, who was a Burmese Vipassana meditation teacher in the Burmese monastery there. I learned from him. And I would sit under the Bodhi tree, the people tree that Buddha sat under for enlightenment. And I sat there and meditated from sunrise to sunset, trying to emulate the spirit of Lord Buddha, who left everything for enlightenment. He was a prince. It deeply moved me. I hitchhiked. In India, hitchhiking was jumping through the window of a third-class train. You had to jump through when the train was still moving fast, because by the time the train stopped, it was too packed with people for anyone to get in, including ticket collectors. So it was free. So I went to Bombay, and I took a meditation course there. And one day after the meditation course, I started walking. I didn't know where I was going. That was basically my itinerary, because I never knew where I was going. But I felt I was going toward God. So I was walking and walking for hours, and I was in downtown, and I somehow or other I looked up at a stoplight and I saw a big sign that said Spiritual Festival at Cross Maidan Park. So I thought, this is wonderful. A spiritual festival, I'll go. It was a gigantic tent. And I was there. I saw some people singing, some books on display. And as the evening approached, 25 to 30,000 people assembled in this huge tent to hear the guru. And I was very shy in those days. Actually, I still am, but somehow or other, I pretend I'm not. I was way in the back corner. Tens and thousands of people. And the guru came on the stage. It looked so beautiful. He had shaved head and saffron robes. He walked with the grace of a swan, with the certainty of a king, and with the humility of one who is seeing God. He sat down as his students were singing kirtan, spiritual songs. And I remember thinking, I really would like to get closer, because he was so far away I could hardly see him. But I was so shy, I felt I'm not worthy of stepping in front of anyone else, so I just sat there. Then I saw this saintly person call over one of his followers and speak something to him, and that follower was looking for about 5 minutes and then started motioning for someone to come, but nobody came, so he came down off the stage, started walking through thousands and thousands of people to the very back of the crowd, walked right up to me and said, Srila Prabhupada wants you to sit with him on the stage. I asked, how does he know me? I never got an answer. He just took me by the hand and pulled me up, and he was much bigger than me. And he pulled me through the crowds. And I wasn't pulling back. I was very accustomed to just flowing with destiny. And he took me to the stage and brought me right before Srila Prabhupada. And Srila Prabhupada smiled at me with eyes glistening with compassion and offered me to sit just a few feet away from him. So I sat. And I felt so totally out of place. All his followers were in pristine, beautiful, clean, new robes, and the ladies were with colorful saris, and they had shaved heads, and ladies had beautiful braided hair. And myself, I hadn't shaved or combed my hair in over a year. I didn't even know what I looked like. I hadn't looked in a mirror, and I didn't know how long. I thought looking in a mirror was vanity. I was really strict. And I looked down at my robes. They were the same robes that that person gave me months before on the banks of the Ganges. By this time, they were soiled gray because I was usually washing them in muddy rivers or muddy lakes or muddy ponds, and they had holes in them and they were tattered. And I was thinking, God, I must look really filthy and dirty sitting on stage with all these clean, effulgent people. And I was used to living in jungles. And here I was, 30,000 people looking at me. And I decided, I'm getting out of here. And just when I was about to get up and run away, Srila Prabhupada looked at me. He was singing. He was leading a kirtan. And he looked at me. And he just, a slight smile and eyes of such reassurance. It was like, this is where you're supposed to be. He didn't say anything with his voice, but this is what I was hearing through his glance. And I felt completely at comfort and at ease. And it was as if it was just the two of us and all these tens and thousands of people didn't even exist. It was beautiful. And it was on that night that I first met His Holiness Tamal Krishna Goswami Maharaj in a very, very special and intimate way, who was to become one of my most beloved guides and inspirations over decades. I stayed, and Srila Prabhupada invited me every morning and evening to sit beside him for 2 weeks. until that festival was over. And I decided then, I'm not ready to choose a path yet. I have to keep searching. So I went to live with Swami Muktananda in Ganeshpuri and his guru's samadhi, Swami Nityananda. I went to Goa to try to get a new visa. Then I went back to Himalayas and stayed with the Dalai Lama in his monastery. And I met him. I also met Mother Teresa in Calcutta. I remember the Dalai Lama. He was so kind, so affectionate. And in him I saw something so special, that he was sacrificing his life for the good of his people, even though he was under such severe death threats and attack. And he was so joyful doing it, to make sacrifices for the welfare of others. This was becoming the universal principle I was seeing in saintly people of all traditions. Compassion. Mother Teresa, she told me that the biggest problem in this world is hunger, not hunger of the stomach, but hunger of the heart. And the only thing that could fill the hunger of the heart is God's love and love for others. And somebody asked her in my presence, where do you get the strength, just a little old lady, to do all the things that you do? And she took out her rosary and said, all the strength I have is coming from the name of God. It was this constant reminder. Eventually, many things happened, but I was on my way to a pilgrimage to Lord Shiva in Kashmir, and I was in an overcrowded train. 60 people were the capacity of the train, and there was about 250 to 300 smashed in together. And we were in a field during a monsoon rainstorm that flooded. The train couldn't move for 25 hours. There was no water, there was no food, and it was really heavily recycled air to breathe. And we couldn't get out. It's a muddy field with snakes floating around. The train moved. Movement is so nice. This was like the ultimate traffic jam. It was a steam engine. And finally it stopped. And 5 in the morning, I got out of the train. I was praying all the way, God, please show me my path. I'm meeting so many great people and so many great teachings, and I love all of them, but I don't know what to follow. What is my path? And I was thinking, in Kashmir, where I'm going on this pilgrimage, I was told anyone who goes there, all their desires are fulfilled. I was feeling in my heart, something is going to happen that's going to change my life. I was expecting it to happen on that mountain. But I got off at this station, crawled out a window just to drink some water and to breathe air and to move. So I moved around and I drank a lot of water from the tap of the railway station. And I breathed a lot. And then the train, the whistle blew. I jumped through a window and bounced off a wall of flesh. Another and another and a door and a door. The train was gone and I was stranded. Where am I? I asked somebody, where am I? He said, this is Mathura, Krishna's birthplace. And today is Janmashtami, Krishna's birthday. come with me, I will take you to the place. So I went. And I heard all about this place called Vrindavan, which is where Krishna grew up. And I was thinking, I'll go there for 3 days, and then I'm going to Kashmir. There's a lot more to the story, but I don't have time. Anyways, after 3 days of being there, I was decided the next morning I'm going to Kashmir. I was sleeping on the bank of a river. And I woke up in the morning. I was never so sick in my life. And believe me, in Afghanistan and Iran, I had dysenteries that made me so incredibly sick. It was like, it's hard to live through. But nothing compared to this. I was burning with a fever. My stomach was churning with poison. My head was spinning with nausea. I couldn't stand up. I couldn't even lift my arms. I was so weak. I laid there for hours and hours. Vultures started circling above me. Every now and then they'd come down and peck at me to see if I was living. They knew that the fever was cooking me, and they were waiting for me to be well done. And I couldn't move. And I blacked out several times. And finally, an old farmer saw me there and just picked me up like a bale of hay and threw me on the back of his ox cart and took me to a charitable hospital. They diagnosed me with severe typhoid fever. And they told me, after about 10 days in this hospital, and I'm not going to explain what charitable hospitals were like in those days in India, especially in Vrindavan, it was whatever disease you had, be prepared for a lot of diseases much worse than what you got. The person next to me had tuberculosis, and he was coughing blood all over me. He was this far away. And I was praying a lot. And when I finally got discharged from the hospital, the doctor said, if you travel, you will die. You have to stay in one place. By the time I got better, Vrindavan, which is the capital of bhakti for the whole India, the people, the spontaneity of their love, their devotion, and the concept of Radha, the feminine aspect of the divine, the compassionate, forgiving aspect of the truth. Krishna is the male aspect of God, and Radha is the female aspect of God. This is how the Lord is worshipped in Vrindavan. This concept fascinated me. And the humility, the devotion, the dedication, and the love of these people, just common farmers, common little merchants. It charmed me. And as I was hearing stories and learning teachings, I decided I want to stay here for the rest of my life. And then about 5 months later, Srila Prabhupada came to visit with some of his people. And it was then I was so deeply moved by his compassion and his wisdom and the authenticity in which he was presenting a tradition that I was now so familiar with. I decided, this is my calling. Many things happened, but eventually my visa ended and I had to go back to the West. And when I was with my parents, I left as a college student hippie that was going for a European vacation for the summer, and I returned a hardcore ascetic, deeply absorbed in spiritual traditions that were completely incomprehensible to them. I had not been inside a house for years, because I always slept in riverbanks under trees or in caves. So it was a culture shock to me to be in their house. And it was a culture shock for them to see me without a suitcase, but with a begging bowl coming home after all these years. And I remember, through my letters, I explained some of my life to them. When I first came in the house, I saw in the kitchen an entire library of vegetarian cookbooks that my mother was practicing on for when I would return so she could cook according to my diet. So gracious, so loving. They tried to understand me and I tried to understand them, and it was a challenge. But I learned from this challenge that if we accept people for who they are or what they are, and not try to force changes, but try to live by our own convictions with compassion, our love for each other can grow deeper and greater than ever before. And that's what happened with my parents. They became so proud. They came to India three times to meet me and had me perform the baptism for all their grandchildren in a Krishna temple. And I kind of had to make up the ceremony. But the essence was there, so I considered it very authorized. The essence of blessing. And when my mother passed away about 5 years ago, my two brothers and my father and aunts and uncles, they all decided we will cremate her. Why? Because she loved what Radhanath Swami was doing so much. She loved what he was doing. She loved who he was. She loved his people. That she would want her ashes to be in India with them. In our Jewish family, this was the first time in history, as far as we can know, that any person was cremated. And I was asked to give the eulogy at her funeral, and I brought her ashes back to India. And I'm going to end with this. There were about 2,000 to 3,000 of our devotees on the banks of the Ganges singing beautiful prayers for her from their hearts, as I offered her ashes, the ashes of my mother to the Mother Ganges. And I was thinking that the mother of my material life and the mother of my spiritual life have merged together. And I, with tears in my eyes, I prayed to God, Krishna, that please carry my mother into the sea of your grace. And I was thinking this was very symbolic, this instance, because bhakti means integrating the body, the mind, and the soul in harmony with the spirit. Thank you very much.
That we can't really appreciate sweetness for what it is. They even taste sour to us. And that we're not even qualified to read the scriptures without the aid of the guru to show us what it really means. So it seems like there's a conflict between going with your heart, with what you feel, but also submitting yourself to the authority of following the instructions and directions. So what to do? How can we achieve that?
Thank you. When we follow our heart, we're aspiring for something that's deeply meaningful and fulfilling in life. And when it comes to that point, where we really want to make very deep and substantial spiritual progress, then following our heart means accepting, submitting ourselves before the will of God, which is coming through His holy words in the scriptures, which is coming through saintly persons, which is coming through the Guru. When our heart wants to please the Lord in that way, when our heart wants to become humble and pure through the guidance and the grace of Guru and life, then that act of surrender is the perfection of following our hearts when we come to that step. In other words, what is the heart and what is the whimsical mind? We have to differentiate. What really does my heart want and how to reach there? Not just whatever my mind wants. This is my experience. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for the book. Thank you for these beautiful stories. They're very moving. And I happened to look at the pictures of your journey. Some of them, I saw a picture of the rock that you described sitting on the river, and a picture of the Dalai Lama with you and the Dalai Lama together. And I'm wondering, where do you put your pictures? The beauty of the story the beauties are so amazing and so unexpected. And so I know that there's an unexpected way that you have the pictures. And it's beautiful mystery for me.
Where did I get the pictures, you asked?
Yeah, how did you keep them in your travels?
I didn't keep them. There was only one I kept.
Okay.
Well, the pictures of my parents and the pictures of me as a little boy and the pictures of me as a teenager, my parents kept those. They were in their house. And there was one picture of me when I was living in the Himalayas. That was a visa picture for a visa extension that somehow or other I kept in my diary.
There was one of you and Gary
together. That picture... We had no camera, we had no pictures. So what happened is, years after this, now the whole story of Gary is part of the book. That's very supernatural and mystical, and I'm not going to tell you anything about it. But years later, Gary was walking down the street in California. And there's a section in the book that my editors removed about two girls that we met in Italy that we hitchhiked with. anyways, years later in a street in California, he happens to meet this girl, Christina. And she says, Gary, Gary, do you remember me from years ago? We met in Italy. He said, yes, yes. And they talked for a while, and they exchanged addresses. And a few days later, he got a photograph that she took. We didn't even know she was in Athens. She took that photo of our blues band in Athens, Greece, street band. And he had that all these years, and he showed it to me. So I put it in the book, because that was one of the few things of our journey. And that photo of Asim and myself, years later when I met Asim, he gave me a photograph of him and me. So I had that. And the other photos, basically with Mother Teresa and Dalai Lama, I met them again. I met them both several times, and those photos were taken later on. So somebody else had them and gave them to me for the book. And the photos of all the saints and gurus and yogis I met, they were basically, I didn't have those. I just got those photos from different places. I tried to get photos of what they looked like when, at the time I knew them.
That's a story in itself.
There are two people here who really helped to encourage me and teach me how to write books. Manmohini Devi and Ladini Shakti. Please come forward and bring Tamal. If not for them, I don't think I could have ever done this, because the first draft of this book was about 200 pages, one paragraph. And she's a professor of writing and English. So her Gurudev was one of the people who really pushed me to write this book. So I really didn't want to do it, but their encouragement and their help really, really was absolutely invaluable. And I would like, if they could just say a couple words. It was such fun working with the two of you. And they just happened to show up tonight. Please, I want to thank them, and please thank them.
I just want to thank Maharaj, really, for being in all our lives. I met Maharaj in New York in 1984, and I had already been on the spiritual path, but I had never met someone who embodied everything I was seeking so absolutely and so beautifully and so attractively. And when Maharaj sent his manuscript to us many years later, I think it was based on the fact that he had become aware of my wife's skills as a writer. She chronicled a visit that Maharaj made to Dallas after the disappearance of our initiating guru, Maharaj. And he appreciated her writing very much. But essentially, I just want to say it was a thrill for us to be of any service to him, because every moment that we remember him, every moment that we get to see him, everything that he has to say to us lifts us up, inspires us, fills us, directs us. So it's our great joy and privilege to have worked with him. And we were just so excited about his story. Anyone who has read this book understands that it really gives you life. It takes you deeper, however deep you've gone, and encourages and refreshes you. So I'll allow my wife to speak also.
Thank you, Maharaj. Thank you especially for giving this story to the world. I remember the first time I met Maharaj. I don't know if he remembers it, but it was at the Rainbow Gathering in Arizona back in the 90s, I think. And people had been speaking about Radhanath Swami and the way he could tell stories and chant. And I knew I had to hear him. And the first time I heard him, it was in a teepee, and he was playing a harmonium, and he was telling the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. And I was really struck by his ability to chant metrically. I didn't know people still had that ability in the modern world. And being a person who studies literature and writes prose, I was noticing how metrical he was in his telling of these things spontaneously. Most of us rely on books and we write poetry. So I was blown away. I thought that it was like Homer had fallen into the lap of the modern world, this oral storyteller, and I thought it was so bizarre that there could be such a person walking the planet these days. And of course, I fell in love with Maharaj the first time that I met him there. And so I don't know, it was our good fortune, through the mercy of our Guru Maharaj, Tamal Krishna Goswami, that Maharaj sent us that manuscript, and it was the greatest service of our life, really. And we believed in that story from the start, because what struck me, and I'm sure it's striking all of you, is the epicness of the story, that somebody in 1970, in the 20th century, could make such a journey, such a physical journey. I think for a lot of us, you know, we can't conceive of making those journeys. It becomes more of, if we're going to say yes to the adventure and cross the thresholds and deal with the trials and tribulations, it's usually more of an inward journey, as it was for Maharaj too, but he had that great physical journey. The epicness of it, the fact that it was a memoir, which is just so important in this age, a travel narrative, everything came together to create just this perfect story. So I believed in that story from the very, very start. And I want to thank you, Maharaj, for bringing that story to the world. I think the world needs your story.
I really like to take the opportunity to thank all of you for coming and sharing with us this evening with Radhanath Swami. We hope that you are inspired as I was. This wonderful story, this wonderful experience that Radhanath Swami shared with us. And hopefully it also calls us to go deeper in our own spiritual journeys. So thank you very much. And we'll continue with the book signing.
Let's once again give thanks to Maharaj.